Hi, it's George, one of the authors here at the Uncommon Commons. Back in April, we did a live show at Zyder's American Dream Theater. Unfortunately, we weren't able to record the show itself, but we decided to make this studio recording to hopefully give you a taste of what it would be like to see Uncommon Commons live. Special thanks to Noel Son and Rebecca Tewksbury for contributing at the $5 level on our Patreon. At $5 a month, you too can get shouted out right here on an episode, and at $1 a month, you can get access to all of our bonus content, including our ongoing actual play podcast, Need to Escape. Our theme song was composed by Charles Adam Robinson, and our logo was designed by Sam Vitale. Today's stories are Audience Participation by George Plank and Spring Assembly by Alex Vitale. Content warnings can be found in the episode description. Stay, and remember, nothing is real. Hey, Jane! You're never going to believe what I found under the house. A basement! What are the odds? Anyway, this little guy was... Jane, could you come here for a second?
Ugh, what is it, John? I was just... Whoa.
Have they always been here?
Nope.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Well, I'm going to pretend like I didn't see any of that.
Yeah, what?
My life was significantly better before I knew that... They existed.
Isn't that what you usually say about me?
Ugh.
Hi. My name's John. You've already met Jane. Welcome to our apartment building. That isn't to say we own it or anything. It's just we seem to be the only two people living here. Unless you include Doreen, of course. Can I get you anything? We don't have any snacks, and I can't exactly go out and get some, because outside these doors is a barren white void, and...
Hey, John, if you're done giving exposition to the wall, maybe you can help me with something a little more urgent.
Yeah?
Did you see this flyer? They're holding auditions for the apartment's production of Little Shop of Horticulture.
Little Shop of what?
Little Shop of Horticulture? It's a play about a guy who works at a plant shop.
And?
That's it.
Oh! Okay, well, have fun.
Oh, come on. John, you have to audition with me.
Oh, no. I don't think so. I wouldn't be caught dead on stage. Besides, it's not like it's mandatory or anything.
Attention all residents of the Uncommon Commons. Participation in the audition process is mandatory. You should have received your sides by mail. Failure to comply will result in eviction followed by death. See you there.
I didn't get any sides. Did you get a side?
No. It said in the mail, right? Hang on. Oh, here we go. A one for me and one for occupant.
Hey, that's me.
It sure is.
What kind of play did you say this was again?
You know, I thought I knew, but now I'm not so sure.
Maybe they're going in a bold new direction. Something avant-garde.
Yeah, maybe.
John Doe, please make your way to the audition zone.
Well, I'm up. Want to tell me to break a leg?
Good luck.
Thanks.
You may begin when ready.
Charles took a seat a few rows from the very back of the slowly filling theater. The show hadn't even started, and he was already dreading this whole ordeal. He wasn't exactly what you'd call a big theater guy. In school, they had taken his class to see a staging of some Mark Twain stories, but aside from that, he had no interest at all. He probably wouldn't even be here today if a friend of his hadn't texted him the other day. He could remember it distinctly. He was seated on the couch and watching something. It really didn't matter what. He wasn't paying attention anyway. His phone buzzed somewhere nearby, and after a moment of feeling around on his hands and knees, he fished it out from beneath the couch. Hey, Chuck, it's Stan. Just wanted to let you know I'm going to be doing a show at the Zimmerman Theater. Let me know if you want to see it. I have a few comps so I can get you in for free. He and Stan weren't ever really that close. They had been on the same floor their freshman year of college, so they attended a lot of the same functions. Charles always felt a little guilty that he didn't stay in touch with anyone from that time. Most of them moved away or moved on. Stan's invitation came just when Charles needed a friend the most. And now, here he was. Maybe. He thought to himself. He and Stan could get a drink after the show and catch up. He remembered seeing somewhere that people generally get dressed up to go to the theater, so he wore his finest polo shirt that didn't have a mustard stain on it anywhere. Charles flipped through the pages of the program. He had never heard of this show before, but honestly, unless someone dies during a production and it makes the news, Charles didn't know any shows. Despite this, the show boasted a large cast. He scanned a couple of the bios. There weren't many trained actors in the cast. They all came from largely different walks of life and experience levels. Take Donna G, for example. Her bio said something to the effect of, Donna G was born in 1962. She had been a banker for 27 years before joining the production in 2017. Most of them were like that. Short introductions, followed by the year they joined the production. Flipping further, Charles figured there must have been a printing error as the bios ended halfway down the page, and there was still 5 blank pages before moving on to dedications. The crowd was still shuffling in. Large gaps in the seating arrangement left the impression that the show was definitely not sold out. The lights began to dim, and the smattering of conversations around him did too. Suddenly, there came a scream from behind him. Charles turned, expecting to see some horrifyingly gruesome act, but what he saw was much worse. An actress wearing a red cocktail dress started a monologue and walked down the aisle. Out of his peripheral vision, Chuck could see others dressed in 1920s-ish period clothing also starting to walk down the aisles. Then, like a cockroach nest upset underneath a kitchen stovetop, more and more actors emerged, some from the stage, others from the wings, and they began to work their way into the audience, all the while singing in seemingly random keys. A particularly enthusiastic newsboy tried to engage Charles in a bit of character work. Charles looked down and away, refusing to participate. Eventually, the newsboy moved on to the 2 elderly women a few rows in front of him. They seemed to be enjoying themselves. Charles sighed deeply and allowed himself to relax for a moment. The joints of his fingers ached, and he realized that he had been gripping his armrest so tight that his knuckles were on the verge of turning white. Slowly, all the actors returned to the stage. Charles wasn't sure what he expected from a free show, but he didn't expect this. At times, it seemed like the actors were singing different songs entirely. Even though the words they sang were the same, their melodies were completely off. Occasionally, 2 of them would be so far off from the rest that they would accidentally harmonize, but that would only last for a moment before returning to the cacophony they had been cultivating for themselves. All the while, Charles felt less and less comfortable. Maybe the musical stylings had a hand in it, but if he had to pinpoint anything in particular, it would have been that he felt watched. The theater was dark, sure, but something in the way the actors scanned the audience made him feel ill at ease. Every now and again, he would catch one of the people off to the side staring him down, and only once he stared back for a considerable length of time would they eventually move on with the scene. It felt like hours before the lights came up. Charles shuddered a little before rising to his feet.
Well, that was certainly interesting, one of the older women said. What do you think they're going to do after intermission?
Intermission? Oh, we're only about halfway through, Charles thought to himself.
For a split second, he considered slipping out the back of the theater before he felt his front pocket buzz.
Hey, Chuck, glad to see you out there. Are you enjoying the show?
Yeah, I'm having a blast, he lied.
Hey, that's great. Can I get a favor from you real quick?
Sure.
He waited for a response, but none came. The lights flashed a couple times, and people started finding their way back to their seats. Charles figured that Stan might have just been called away to places, right? That was a thing that he heard in a movie once, actors get called to places. The lights dimmed, and Charles took one last look at the exit before sitting down and bracing himself for whatever came next. The lights came up on stage, and the entire cast came out one by one like an oppressively long train blocking your way home. As they sang, they tried to lead the audience in a clap, but it seemed like they themselves couldn't agree on which beat they should clap. So there were people clapping on the 2 and the 4, the 1 and the 3, and the 5 and the 7. Finally, the end of the train was signaled by Stan coming out. He seemed to be carrying a simple wooden chair. He placed it facing outward in the middle of the stage. The cast took positions in a small semicircle around the seat and began to pantomime as if they were searching for something. Stan's search stopped on Charles, and he pointed his finger out. Everyone in the cast turned to look at Charles before the beam from a spotlight was also turned on him, temporarily blinding him.
By the time the spots in his eyes became manageable again, two cast members had flanked him on either side. He looked to the stage, and it appeared that Stan was waving him down. Oh, great, he thought. Audience participation. At first, he tried to politely decline, but as more members of the cast started to beckon him down, even more members of the audience were turning around to see what the holdup was. Put on the spot, he eventually relented, and the cast member showed him the best way to get down. Several members of the audience lightly applauded him as he made his way to the stage. He even gave an awkward smile and a wave before taking the seat in the center. Once again, the cast started to sing, each of them in their own discordant way. As they did, they worked their way around the chair, making a little dancing ring of people that surrounded him. He was amazed at just how different the music sounds from on stage versus the back of the theater. He could almost make out the tune that they were singing along to. In fact, the longer he stayed on stage, the better the sound became. He even found himself tapping his feet in time with the beats, if there was one. His shoulders started to move in syncopation, and this wouldn't have been so alarming had it been of his own free will. "What's happening?" he screamed, and they just sang louder. His fingers splayed and fanned out, allowing him to jazz hand. "What's going on?" they just sang louder. After a minute of this, they stopped singing. There was a beat, and Charles leapt onto the chair and began belting. This earned a massive reaction from the audience. They cheered and applauded, and he sang. He performed the rest of this number, and joined in the next, and the next. In between, he knew every line and never missed a cue. He stayed on stage through the curtain call, the standing ovation, and when at last the curtains finally closed. The lights went down, and so too did every head on stage. All around Charles, faces were lit by the glow of cell phones, as was his. He crafted and sent a quick text message. "Hey, Daria, I'm doing a show at Zimmerman's. I've got some comp tickets. Want to come?" Charles Bottlegig, graduated from OCU in 2017, joined the production in 2023.
This is a 6 month in a row that Ephusius has been in retrograde. I'm starting to think this whole thing is made up. Oh, hey, how'd it go?
Well, I don't want to risk it, but I really don't think I got the part.
Congratulations?
Thank you. You know, it takes a lot of hard work to be this bad. I skipped every theater class, refused to participate in any improv scene.
Yes, and?
No, but...
I'm still not convinced, John. There's a lot of roles in the show, and only two of us in the whole apartment.
Three if you count Doreen.
Right, but she's so busy with all of her cats that she can't even be bothered to come down and audition.
You may have a point, Jane. Oh, this doesn't look good.
Don't worry. While you were in the audition zone, I was looking over my sides. I'm going to do so well that they'll have no choice but to rewrite the whole play into a one-person show.
I wish I had your confidence.
Don't. It's a burden being this talented.
Jane Doe to the audition zone.
Oh, that's my cue.
Yeah, good luck.
What did you just say to me?
Good luck? It's what you said to me.
Oh. No, I think you misheard me. I said knock 'em dead.
Go ahead. Do the thing.
The queerest memory I have from elementary school isn't from the first day of school, or from picture day, or from the day before summer break classroom parties. It's not from math class, or social studies, or even arts and crafts. It's from our yearly assemblies. Not the ones about the dangers of drugs, either. No, the ones I remember most clearly are the ones hosted by Mr. Jingles. I don't remember the assemblies themselves, because I never stuck around long enough to actually watch them. I do remember sitting on the dusty floor of the hallway outside the auditorium, crying my eyes out into the knees of my jeans. Where my teacher, Mrs. Pulaska, went, I don't really know. She gave up trying to console me about 5 minutes into my breakdown. I guess she must have given up and went to call my mom, because about 10 minutes later, she came running in the front door of the school to rescue me. I can still hear her clunky work heels clacking across the linoleum. To this day, I have no idea why they find it necessary to hold Mr. Jingles' assemblies every year. But without fail, spring break would creep nearer, and Mr. Jingles would appear on stage to educate us kids. The show was always the same. One student from the local high school would be dragged on stage by Mr. Jingles, arm being pulled by the puppet that it was attached to. I mean pulled, literally, too. It was the same shtick time and time again. The student would shout something about not being ready from off stage, and then switch to Mr. Jingles' voice as he demanded that they shake a leg. The student would pantomime being dragged onto the stage, all the while Mr. Jingles would shout empty words of encouragement at his puppeteer. The real show began once they were up there. Although show might be a stretch, it consisted mostly of slapstick comedy, antiquated anecdotes, and loosely slung together morals. Regardless of the lackluster performance, I hated it. With a passion. I hated Mr. Jingles. Ever since the first grade, when assembly attendance became mandatory, I dreaded the spring break assembly. I dreaded seeing the dangly, stretchy limbs of Mr. Jingles flail around on stage, of having to meet his dead, soulless black button eyes, of listening to that scratchy, bubbly, falsetto voice. Of course, as a kid, I had none of these descriptors. Mostly, I relied on tears and wails of agony to describe my visceral fear, and that usually worked to get me out of that horrific, mandatory assembly. Once my mother had calmed me down, she would take my hand and lead me out of school. In reality, I was usually the one pulling her out the doors. Another minute in that school and Mr. Jingles might get me. The following week of spring break would be tainted by nightmares of Mr. Jingles. His spindly arms would creak open the door of my closet and slither under the covers of my bed. I spent most of spring break pulling all-nighters until Easter Sunday, where my Easter basket would inevitably become my pillow. The simple days of elementary school came and went, with only a little childhood trauma to spice things up. By fifth grade, I'd outgrown my fear of Mr. Jingles. Mostly. I, at the very least, no longer cried at the very sight of him. The nightmares would stick around, but by then I'd learned how to cope. Middle school proved to be a new and exciting experience. My old cohort of friends from elementary school had gotten split up in the districting of the middle schools, so I was forced to find a new group. I can't say I settled in with the popular kids, but the art kids were plenty good by my standard. We were a motley crew, spanning the full rank from sixth graders to eighth graders. Some of us, like myself, were artists in a more traditional sense. I still have some questionably executed ceramic sculptures to prove it. Others were the dreaded theater kids, kids like Luann, or Lulu, as she called herself. Lulu loved the theater, but it didn't love her. She tried out for every play, every cabaret our school hosted, but no roles ever stuck. None except one. She was in eighth grade when I met her, so most of her lackluster acting career I learned through word of mouth. But for whatever reason, she took a liking to me. I liked her too, in that goofy, wobbly-legged, starry-eyed way that young, still very much in the closet lesbians do. Despite her history of bombed auditions and humiliating performances, I thought she was perfect. Dionysus in the form of an awkward, tween-aged girl. Maybe that's why I listened to her when she approached me that faithful Tuesday afternoon. "Hey, Olivia!" She summoned me over to the round table, the place that she dubbed our signature spot to eat at lunch. I walked over, balancing my tray in one hand and a near-expired carton of chocolate milk in the other. "Hey," I replied, dumbly. Words were always hard around Lulu. She had the decency to let me set my food down and plop into a seat before she laid into me. "I've got a favor to ask you." "Sure," I said, too quickly. It turned out that that favor was an after-school extracurricular, one that consisted more of a repeated obligation than a favor. After the last bell had rung, Lulu met me outside Mr. Gherkin's algebra class. Before I could even get a word out, she wrapped her hand around my wrist and took off down the hallway with me in tow. I was too preoccupied with the white-hot burning of skin-on-skin contact to notice where we were going until we got there. The back of the auditorium was dimly lit and extremely cramped. Piles of old theater sets built an extra layer of walls around the perimeter of the area, and bins full of dusty polyester costumes were crammed into the corners. We were in Lulu's domain now. My eyes traveled up from where she had grabbed my wrist as she let go. And for the first time that afternoon, I met her eyes. They had a sparkle in them that I was all too accustomed to. All of our friend group was. She wanted something. It was then I noticed it. It sat behind her in one of the costume bins, spilling over the sides like dirty laundry from a basket. I spoke before I could stop myself. "What is that thing doing here?" Lulu's face split into a wide smile, and she left my side to go pull the gangly monstrosity from its seat. "I've been doing a Mr. Jingles show since last year." She held it on her hip like a baby, those long, spindly limbs bouncing lamely against her thighs. "The next show is happening soon. Next week." I eyeballed the puppet skeptically. I'd known that Lulu had been doing the assembly for some time. She was proud of the role and didn't try to keep quiet about it. I don't think she heard the snickers behind her back. Yeah, I remember. I hadn't thought about the assembly in a long time. On purpose. What I didn't remember, though, was Mr. Jingles looking so sad. Horrific, sure. Grotesque, absolutely. The thing in front of me now, slumped loosely in Luann's arms, was much worse than how it appeared in my dreams. Gone were the vibrant, clownish colors that it had worn before. Age hadn't been kind to it, and all its garish, rainbow-plated clothing had faded to a dirty, muted set of robes. One of its button eyes threatened to fall off, and its seams looked less like they were bursting and more like they were slowly coming apart. Nevertheless, a large, toothy grin was stitched into its face, with two craggy rows of yellow-white plastic teeth inlaid in its movable jaw. I remember wondering if it was still in use, why didn't anyone fix it? For a brief moment, I even felt bad for it. That was quickly washed away as memories of nightmares came flooding back. "Well, I was thinking," Lulu began. She switched the thing from one hip to the other. "I'm moving away next year." I bit the inside of my cheek. She told us the week before. I tried to pretend it wasn't happening. "And I need someone to fill in the role for me after I'm gone." Mr. Jingle's head, hollow without a hand to fill it, flopped to one side. His button eyes regarded me coolly. I fixed my eyes solely on Lulu. "I thought it was high schoolers that did the assembly." "They used to, but it's been harder for the school to find volunteers. My tutor recommended me for the role, and, well, I wasn't an actress, and I told her so." "You don't have to be," she assured me. She hoisted Mr. Jingles off her hip and held it under its armpits, thrusting it out towards me. "There's a script and everything. You barely need to do anything." I pushed the puppet aside. "I don't know the first thing about any of this." The smile she gave me was radiant. The kind you see on magazine covers hawking diet advice at teenage girls. It was warm, beautiful, and held promises and secrets that I desperately wanted to be a part of. For a moment, Mr. Jingles was as far out of my mind as he could have been. All there was Lulu. In front of me. Smiling just for me. Asking for a favor. Of course I said yes. A core memory is being made now, too. It sits nestled in my arms, long, long legs dangling over my forearm and threatening to brush the floor. Its ratty, felt-covered head turns to look at me. My hand, attached to my wrist, and my wrist to my arm, and my arm to the rest of me, pivots. My fingers are enveloped by old and grimy fabric, pilled by decades of different people's sweat soaking the innards of this pathetic excuse for a puppet. Inside, I feel my fingers flex, but I don't remember telling them to move.
"Are you ready, Olivia?"
it says in its squeaky, high falsetto. The corners of my lips move with its words. My vocal cords vibrate along with its question. Its words, its question, not mine. "No," I say in my own voice. A bead of cold sweat dribbles down the back of my neck in tandem with the one down my arm. Its arm.
"Yes, you are,"
it corrects cheerfully. Its voice grows louder and my throat grows scratchy with effort.
"It's time for the show to begin. Come on, Olivia, the people are waiting."
"No," I shout, firmer. There's a tugging first at my toes. It travels upward to my ankle, then my calf, then knee, then thigh, until my leg moves. One foot in front of the other. Slowly, purposefully, towards the part in the curtain. "No, I'm not ready," I try again. My body aches as I try to pull back. My free hand clings to the edge of the curtain, but by now where I'm visible to the students in the audience. There are a couple of forced chuckles. Teachers. The falsetto gets even louder, and the corner of my mouth tears ever so slightly in the effort.
"Come on already, let's get this show on the road."
The grip of my fingers slips, loosened by something that is not my own will, and I stumble onto the stage. My arm, its arm, straightens immediately. I feel my forearm twist, wrist and hand turning to scan the crowd. My vertebrae pop one by one as I'm straightened up, too. The audience is full of students, shapeless entities against the blinding brilliance of the stage light.
"Well, hi there, kids,"
says the puppet, says Mr. Jingles. My lips ache as it speaks.
"Today we've got a very important lesson for you. Are you all ready to learn?"
Among the collective groan of the student body is one shrill wail. It's punctuated by the slamming of the auditorium door.
Man, Need Park season tickets are surprisingly cheap. Oh, hey, Jane, how'd it go?
Well, I don't want to brag, except I do.
A reminder to all residents. Showboating is strictly prohibited on the premises. Violators will be ejected from the building.
You mean evicted?
No.
When will the cast list go up?
The final results will be available momentarily.
Oh, I hope I get it. I hope I get it.
How many people do they need?
Well, Little Shop of Horticulture actually boasts one of the largest ensembles. So, who knows? There might still be a part of it for you after all.
Don't you put that on me, Jane! That's the last thing I want!
What?
The results are in. This season, we are pleased to announce that the roles...
Ah, just like you said. Congratulations, Jane.
...will be played by...
It's an honor, truly.
Will you let me finish? All the roles in the Complex's production of Little Shop of Horticulture will be played by Doreen Wimbledon's cats.
What?
They were the most prepared for their audition. The lines that they read were actually from the show.
But these were the signs that came in the mail today.
Why would we send out sides on the same day as the audition? Your sides were printed on one page and had a picture from the show.
Oh, that I thought that it was direct mail marketing. I threw it out.
You did what?
Now, Jane, it was a simple mistake.
Yeah, that'll be my line when they ask me how you died.
Watch your mailbox for comp tickets. Stay, and remember, nothing is real.